Okay, is everybody back?
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
All right, terrific. Okay, so we'll start by asking if there are any announcements. Okay, well, I do just want to remind people that to think about sessions for the ADU climate literacy sessions. Next week, we will have our telecom will be devoted to sort of discussing the possibilities and trying to identify topics and conveners. And I will start a Google Doc before that so we can collect ideas from those that can't participate in the call. So that'll be next week. And the deadline's not until like late April. So we have plenty of time. We just want to get the process started. Okay. Any other announcements? Okay, well, if not, we will move on to our presentation for today. Today I have one of my colleagues from TURC, Jilly Puttick, who's going to give us a presentation. Jilly is the co-leader of the Life Science Initiative here at TURC and has been involved in conducting research on science teaching and learning for quite a while. And has been involved in developing curriculum and teacher professional development programs for middle school and high school teachers. And she's also been involved in a lot of climate change education work, both with respect to energy curriculum. So, her co-author on this paper is Brian Drayton. He is the co-director for the Center of School Reform and is also co-leader of the TURC Life Science Initiative. And he couldn't be here today because he's off in some schools around their climate lab project. So I'm going to turn it over to Jilly, who's going to give us a presentation on place, community, and the biosphere, an overview of the TURC Life Sciences Initiative climate education work. And this, everybody should have the slides from the website. So Jilly?
Thanks, Sandra. I want this to be as informal as possible. So how does that work? How do people raise their hand?
People will just speak up. If that's okay with you.
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
So just speak up, and we will respond to questions.
All right. So about a decade ago, Brian and I began a strand of work within the Center for School Reform at TURC. And focus on the life sciences. And it spans quite a breadth of projects in the life sciences, from plant biology to evolution, to studying the effectiveness of lab-based instruction in biology, and of course, climate change. So those are the projects, as Tamara said, that I'll be talking about today. In our education efforts, should I say I've moved on to slide two?
Is that helpful? It's useful if you can say the slide numbers because people might come in late and they won't know where to go.
All right. So slide two. In our education efforts on climate change, we started as ecologists, both of us are PhD ecologists, trying to solve the problem of helping people grasp reality and the significance of climate change. And we brought a strong ecological perspective, especially with our backgrounds in thinking about ecosystems and complexity, of course, for which systems thinking is key. So in this talk, I'll be talking about the successive stages of development of our projects and programs and the evolution over time in our thinking about what constitute, for us, effective components of climate education. This work has spanned informal and formal settings, and it's involved gaining an understanding about the constraints of these different learning environments, and additionally, more recently, an increasing understanding of community involvement in climate change education. I'll also be explaining how our work is built on a theoretical framework that draws from multiple sources, the learning sciences, of course, as an education researcher, from theories of behavior change and from what conservation psychology has to tell us. Oops, that was, I'm getting mixed up. Now I'm on slide three. Our early work at TURC had at least a partial focus on climate change. The Global Lab Project on which Brian was the lead author in the early days, adopted a systems approach with a strong focus on organisms and on place. So students established study sites to study over time, and an organismal focus was looking at the density of stomates on plants and relating these to levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. Slide four. This is Brian's next project, was a high school introductory text. The study of climate change was firmly placed within the biosphere. Students used ecosystems and evolutionary perspectives to think about carbon and energy. So they would progress, for example, from a focus on calculating energy budgets of individual organisms, adaptations for feeding and capturing energy, to the flow of energy and matter in ecosystems, so bumping up an organizational level, to investigating anthropogenic sources of carbon by country around the world, and then extending to carbon in the global system by looking at global carbon budgets. Slide five. So, with these projects as sort of background, we developed an ambitious, we found out later, instructional materials development proposal to NSF. That was back in the day when they were still into the materials development project in a big way. And we developed a year-long capstone course that reflected two developments that had taken place in the scientific community, not the educational community, scientific community with respect to understanding the rapid changes that Earth systems were undergoing. And these were, slide six, biocomplexity and coupled natural and human systems. NSF established two new programs to fund these. Biocomplexity was looking at the interrelationships amongst living things, from molecular structures to ecosystems, to genes, to ecosystems, and how organisms interact with their environment. And then this was followed by the CNH, the Coupled Natural Human Program, which focused on how and where natural processes and cycles on the one hand and human behavior and decisions on the other intersect, especially in the face of increased climate variability and the resulting socio-ecological feedbacks that everybody anticipated and we're now seeing happen. Two additional concepts we integrated in the curriculum were ecosystem services, what functions of ecosystems and natural resources do societies depend on, and also how does an understanding of landscapes as an ecological perspective influence our understanding. Let's see, why is my slide not advancing? Sorry. All right. Okay. Was almost stumped there and didn't know what to say next. Okay, slide seven. In biocomplexity, students research in areas of expertise relevant to a case that they must build in each unit. So in the local unit, they use, besides the field data they gather, they also use data provided by the curriculum using GIS, in this example shown, to quantify land use change. Was that a question or a comment? No? Okay. The Arctic unit is the one, this is slide nine, that focuses most on couplings between human resource use and climate change. And this was we chose to do that in this unit, given that the changes in the Arctic are so dramatically evident. And students take on the challenge of designing a conservation plan, slide 10, for one of five Arctic species shown here. So what they do is learn about these species' life histories in tandem with learning about the abiotic conditions that impact their natural history. And then they must project how these abiotic changes will impact these organisms, and so that their conservation plan needs to account for these future projected changes. So looking back in assessing this body of work, this was the place, or this project was where our thinking about the importance of place, mentioned in the title, became prominent. And I'll talk a bit more about this in a while, but first I want to talk about...
Can I just ask you a quick question as to whether you were able to eventually not only have place be the Arctic, but places that the students actually live?
Yes.
Okay.
So, in fact, the curriculum had four units, and it goes from local, where they think about land use change at their school, to suburban, which is about sprawl, then to regional, which is about Amazonia and the connection to McDonald's and, you know, beef ranching in the Amazon, and then to the Arctic unit as a combination. And then in Arctic, they cycle back to the local because they think about conservation plans in their own community as well. So there's a, you know, it's a constant cycling to what they know and then to a reach to climate change. So slide 11, I think we would all agree on the many challenges that make learning about climate change difficult for students of all ages. And we all know about the evidence that makes this clear that it's a challenge. And so given that the prevailing narrative about climate change can be shaped the way it actually has rolled out in this country today, we know that this is a widespread challenge that we still need to address, though there's recent evidence that the tide may be turning just a little bit. I don't know if you saw the latest survey. So the challenge has been well described by education researchers. In slide 12, some of these are listed. Tina Grosser has described the challenges of attributing causality in understanding climate change. Joe Krychek and Jonathan Osborne and others talk about science practices. And we think this is an important component because people don't understand the practices that underpin what we know about climate change. How do scientists know what we know? How do they create models and use them? And Carol Saunders and Susie Moser have studied the role of affect in influencing what people can and can't learn about climate change. Therefore, we'd like to suggest that a place-based learning approach can counter these kinds of difficulties. So that's what I'll be talking about in the rest of the talk. While from the beginning, slide 13, our work has had a strong focus on ecology, as you probably noticed, the place idea as a bridge to human factors has become much more clear for us and more enriched as we have begun to reckon with a bigger emphasis on humans as ecological actors. And so we began talking to people about their experience of climate change, just collecting stories. And, you know, for example, we know an avid birder who's a non-scientist, and in her birding, she's noticed warblers are moving north. And she's beginning, and that the shrubs that have berries that these migrants eat are beginning to green up earlier. And so these kinds of observations on the part of lay people of on-the-land changes, we feel provide an opportunity to connect to where people are, where their understanding and observations are, and to capitalize on their affinity for where they live and where they're seeing these things. And so this led to the Biosphere and Climate Project. And this supports the collaboration between Turk and nature centers across New England. As we began to develop partnerships with nature centers, we found over and over again that they faced two constraints. One was they don't have access to info about how to connect their existing programs to climate change. And also that their program staff and volunteer docents don't have the confidence to take this on. And so in consultation with them, we began to assemble scientific reports on species affected by climate change in New England. And so the website Biosphere and Climate has a catalog of all of the current research to date on these. But from this resource base, we've begun to develop what we call climate briefs. And these are two-page summaries that sort of encapsulate the research and its research and its significance and the locations where it's taking place, so that these provide support for docents and program staff at the nature centers. Ultimately, we're going to extend this work to encompass professional development for staff and docents as well. But that's a first start. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears and talk about an energy-related project. And the connection here is climate change, and this is contemporaneous with the Biosphere and Climate Project. So we explored energy conservation as another personal connection, another personal way into learning about climate change. And we chose this because we were looking for something that would be accessible to young people. And this program, GECCO, is the Girls Energy Conservation Corps. It's a patch program for Girl Scouts between the ages of 8 and 14. And at baseline, we found that there were two huge gaps in the knowledge and experience of children between these ages. First, they didn't know at all about their personal connection to climate change through their own energy choices. And also, they primarily thought that dirty factories and dirty big trucks, you know, the ones that belch black smoke going down the road, were the causes of climate change. So the goals of the program were simple: to support learning about energy conservation and about climate change, and importantly, their own connection to climate change through their energy choices, and also to take leadership by communicating about energy conservation. So we built the program on a theoretical framework that included social norms. These are strong amongst Girl Scouts. They value taking care of the environment. They value taking leadership, and so there was a natural fit there. We also drew on conservation psychology that emphasizes the impact of emotions, both positive ones about nature and negative ones about the destruction of nature, and the connection of these to people's ability to take on new difficult information. We also built on theories of behavior change that identify and build on different phases of people's intention to change behavior, and that stress action as an important way, especially for kids this age, to counter the despair and powerlessness and hopelessness that can accompany.
What do you mean by stress action?
Well, energy conservation. So, you know, if you're taking action to, even in small ways, turn off lights, you know, nag your little brother to turn off the whatever, you're doing something towards addressing this huge problem. And then finally, that also emphasized the construct of an individual's identity. I am the sort of person who can combat climate change, which is another important, people are finding an important aspect of supporting kids to think about this difficult fact in their world. So slide 21 is about another current project, the Climate Lab, also focused on place. It's a partnership with Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. They're focused primarily on bird conservation on the South Shore of Massachusetts. And this project is part of our push to think about all the different ways and contexts that science about climate change can get shared in the classroom. So it's got features of many environmental projects around the country. They students collect data on local biological indicators as a way into thinking about the impacts of climate change. And at the same time, they're contributing to an interactive database that local scientists will use. So in the context of better understanding patterns they see in the movement of migrant birds through eastern Massachusetts, and I mentioned that, the connection between the synchrony of migrant arrivals and plant green up and insect food and berries and flowers being available and so on. So the man-made scientists have seen changes in the movements of migrant birds. They're detecting patterns. They're not quite sure what the root causes are. Is it here or is it Argentina, or, you know, or everywhere along the way in these migrations? So understanding food supply will be key, and the students are contributing to that. So another approach that spans the classroom and out-of-school education is another current project, Innovate to Mitigate. Slide 22? This project challenges students to come up with a way to mitigate greenhouse gases. Because it focuses on mitigation, students not only learn science in the course of constructing their project, they're also engaged with the social and socio-ecological challenges of mitigation. So they have to think about impact on mitigation impact, what's feasible, what might people adopt as a mitigation strategy. But also key here is this notion of empowerment, because they feel like they're contributing to solutions to climate change. Slide 23 shows the five contestants who made it through to the end of our pilot. One project, they developed school, you can see the green card, and Photoshop for sure, but they developed green roofs for buses and looked, you know, they made the argument that they could adapt the green roof technology for buses, which was a big waste of space. And they did a carbon budget for how much would be mitigated.
So these were competitions, or this competition?
It was a competition, right. But because teachers and graduate students were advisors to teams, the project expands the education ecosystem, if you will, by lowering the walls between informal and formal education about climate change in this project, because they adopt different roles to support their role teams than are traditional. So there's lots of evidence that students are learning and engaged. So, let's see, how long are these talks typically?
The session goes an hour, but you know, if you talk a half an hour, we have a conversation.
I think I'm going to go over half an hour.
No problem.
Hang in there. I've got just a couple more projects to talk about. So then, this was a divergence from, for us, a complete divergence, but also about climate change. I became interested in the affordances of Scratch programming language designed for kids at MIT for learning about climate change.
Can I say a bit about what Scratch is?
No, Scratch is a drag and drop programming language, and so it's designed to be user friendly for kids as young as the age of 7. And programming functions are color coded as actions or actors. Later they get to variables and if then, you know, computational thinking constructs like if then statements, conditional feedbacks. But it's all in a very intuitive sort of lock and key mechanism. So you can drag an actor, that's the first part of your program, you drag an action to make that actor do something, and so before you know it, you've started constructing a computer program. So it teaches computational thinking, and that's very well documented. But people have not studied too much about its affordances to support learning in a domain. And so a couple of projects have shown that kids learn math using Scratch, but to my knowledge, this is only the second project, the first learning about climate change and the second in science. So kids are motivated, they're persistent, and they learn. And we particularly liked the synergy. Slide 25 is a simple way of showing the synergy between making games using programming and computational thinking and systems thinking that are essential for understanding climate change. So, you know, our hypothesis is these affordances will support enrich opportunities for learning as kids create games with a sort of purported goal of teaching other kids about climate change. So we found so far that that young people pick up programming quickly. Those two snapshots of two different programs that were developed, and you can't tell from the production level and from the functionality of the game. One kid has 2 years of programming experience, and the other one has only a week from a workshop that we did. So they focus and persist with this. It was no surprise that the games didn't focus on the big picture of climate change, but typically focused on smaller subsystems. So the lower one was about carbon sequestration by plants, balanced by deforestation. So if you thought of a cycle, just in thinking about that carbon sink. So students take the charge. This is an extension of our thinking about taking action for empowerment. Students take the charge of educating others through game creation very seriously and are passionate about this as a way of protecting the environment. Okay, so shifting back just to talk about our last project, slide 18.
And a couple, yes, I'm sorry, I zoomed ahead and didn't keep you apprised where I was going. You there?
Slide 18?
Slide 18, yes.
I've gone back to slide 18.
So you know what I did? I shuffled this at the last minute, forgetting, of course, to
All right, that's why. Because you skipped a whole bunch of books to me.
Yeah.
And now you're saying to go back.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
Sorry.
Now it's my 18, so I guess for you it's...
Current projects, is right.
Current projects, case identity, environment.
So it's labeled at slide 18.
So from this body of work so far, place identity and environmental identity have become an even more explicit focus for our current work. And these are under active scholarly interest in environmental education at the moment. So they feel like an important additional dimension to us because of the links among cognition, emotion, and potential action. So with regard to place identity, we start to identify ourselves with places when attachment to a place grows. So you love a place, you start to identify with it. You know, I'm a city person. Oh, no, I'm a country mouse. You know, it becomes part of your identity. That's what's meant by that. And then environmental identity is another dimension of how we conceive of ourselves. It's a broader concept, which is likely to involve identifying with conservation efforts and environmentally sustainable behavior. So these two constructs shape the way we began to talk with nature centers. And since we and they are also looking for policy change and changing public attitudes, we felt that community learning about climate change would be an important focus of our work together. So the next slide, climate conversations, we developed this innovation of integrating all many different approaches that are being adopted across all sectors of society by conceiving of communities as the agents of climate education. Each community has many different actors who are engaged in education, and so if we integrate all of their efforts, we think that the strategy will result in a broad and deep educational program. By coordinating their climate change education efforts and drawing on the skills and insights of each sector. So we propose to do this climate conversation to work with communities using nature centers as the nodes, the anchors, the trusted messengers. There's a trusted nature center in each community to build knowledge of climate change and to build educational capacity, and also, importantly, build social capital for community action. And we will adopt essentially a political approach in cross-sector climate conversations. And the idea is that such conversations, this is building on Susie Moses' work, that since they involve careful listening and then the articulation, negotiation, and transformation of values and information together, that a voice and support for ideas and education over time become shared in the group. And so that's a springboard, a board for a coordinated climate change education.
Is this a proposed effort?
Well, we started on a small scale. We don't yet, we have an ASL proposal in right mm-hmm. now to support
this. So have you tried this out at all?
Yes. Yeah, we have. And it's really interesting, actually, the extent to which people can't really move on and think without first acknowledging the sense of loss because of the changes that and the pace of change that we're seeing. So,
how are you getting? Are you getting a consistent set of people to participate in these conversations, or is it just who is at the major center?
Well, we've tried to reach out and have at least educators, business, people in the resource extraction industries like Lobstermen, you know, Sugar Maple Association, folks like that, sustainable farming, and in-school and out-of-school educators. That's sort of the minimum core that we have at each conversation. So there's a diversity of voices, and sometimes people who are deniers, you know, or people who are very nervous about it. Typically there will be at least one or two of Lazarowitz's Six Americas present, you know, at each conversation. So, and then we plan to research the mechanisms and effectiveness of this strategy. So actually, the last slide in conclusion, this table just represents a bunch of
slide 27.
Thank you. The bunch of projects that I talked about, the audience, as you can see, that there's a broad spectrum from middle to high school, community, in school, out of school, community settings. And then the features, there's a strong focus on an ecological or biocomplexity perspective, the notions that I've talked about of place identity, the importance of taking action, and I think, as well as finally an increasing understanding of community involvement. So I think, given that climate change is, you may call it a crisis discipline, it's sort of like where conservation biologists are, they're lurching from one crisis to the next, you know. Because of this, it seems imperative to us to consider all aspects of human endeavors, you know, needs, emotions, capacity to act, psychology, ability to learn, as we continue to experiment with place identity to elicit engagement. We draw on environmental identity to motivate and building opportunities for action, given its positive psychological feedback effect, to design opportunities for learning that align with these dimensions to support learners to build towards increasing complexity and understanding. So, that's it. I'd be happy to take questions.
So, Jillian Bryan, contact information is on the is on slide 28. Are there any questions?
Oh, notice my little beetle on the boat. That's the local to global and back again.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, I've got a couple of
hear about the program though. Oh, okay, I was just going to say it was useful to hear about the program.
Thank you. Another question? A question?
Yeah, this is Randy Russell at UCAR. Hey, I was wondering about your Scratch Girls effort. I see in your table that you say it's an informal sort of setting. Could you say more about sort of what situation or group of people you're doing that with or that kind of thing?
Sure. So far we've run small pilots, and they've been at Turk. We've sent out notices within the Scratch community and within the middle school informal network that we have at Turk. And we've recruited girls. So this was building on the Gecko project, so it was only girls. And we've recruited them for workshops that we've held at Turk and studied here with the idea of building up some evidence that this is a viable approach, and with the hope that we'll go to NSF. We actually have a proposal in at NSF to take this to schools, actually. A couple of local school districts are really keen because they see the opportunity for integrating computer science into science classes. And so they are really excited about the possibility of our partnering on this to develop a climate change education program that deploys Scratch as a way to learn about it.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I think that's a great idea to mix the sort of systems thinking within programming and the systems thinking within climate or ecology or that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, so there's just so many synergies there, you know. You think about feedbacks in programming and feedbacks in systems. You know, iterative testing happens in modeling climate and in testing programs. So there are a whole bunch of synergies there.
Mm-hmm.
Jillie, I was also very excited about that, the Scratch project. And I was very excited to hear you say it's a great mechanism to have kids teaching other kids as they learn. And there's really strong theoretical basis for that with the work of Vygotsky and having kids communicate with kids and share their knowledge as they're learning these modeling
yes.
processes. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Just a little, we haven't focused much research on that. I just got some anecdotal evidence that at the end of both of the workshops that we've had so far here, families who've been invited on the last day, and it's been terrific to see siblings get engaged with the games that their mostly older siblings have designed. And, you know, to see the family interaction as they observe, basically as their siblings use or test their games. There's a lot of talk about the design of the game as well as what constitutes a good game.
Other questions?
Go ahead.
This is Kristen at the Will Steger Foundation. I was, all of these were, I love the outreach into so many different audiences. I was particularly interested in the Climate Conversations Project piece. We're doing something very similar here in Minnesota right now, and I just wondered if you had more, do you have a landing page for that staff for more information just about how you're planning those conversations and just sort of the framework you've used.
Right. Well, so we have some internal documents, and maybe the best approach would be for us to follow up with a conversation. I'd love to talk to you about what you're doing as well.
Great.
So I can put her email.
I'll send you an email.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Terrific.
Other questions?
Is the Scratch game, this is Jane Heinz Fry again, is the Scratch game something that we can play with at this point of the game, or is it not at that stage of development?
Oh, well, the programming software itself is free. You can download it from MIT. If you Google Scratch, you'll come across the MIT Scratch website. So you can play with it yourself. They've got great tutorials, and so, you know, you can have at it. It's really remarkable how quickly kids learn to program using Scratch. The game, so I don't know if you were asking about that or about games that have been developed. Most kids who create games put them on the Scratch community website. So there's a whole database of games that kids have developed. I'm not sure, actually, if our students have done that. But it's worthwhile taking a look at what kids of all ages can come up with.
Do students only produce games with it? Or
no, they produce a whole host of things. They produce animations. You can do, pretty much anything that can be programmed.
And you can actually hook it up to the conversations last week about Arduinos. You can actually have external things that go into it as well, too. It's been really, it's one of those open source things that have been used in a ton of different really cool ways as well, so.
Yeah, Kristen, that's a good point. This is Bonnie. I know that it can be hooked up to motors and things like that so that you can actually create programming to run a windmill, for example, and test the efficiency of the windmill and things like that. So I bring that up because you could have a little engineering design competition where they have to create a windmill out of whatever materials you give them. And then they could write a program in Scratch to run that windmill and test its efficiency. So I think that's a neat idea as well.
So I had a question. So all of your place-based things have been focused around New England. Have you thought at all about extending and being able to transfer that to other places?
So the Climate Lab has built into it scalability. So this year we're testing it just at Manomet. Next year we're incorporating a research center, the Carey Institute in upstate New York, and it was their connections to Baltimore. And then in year three we're including as a partner the folks at Point Blue, which used to be the Point Reyes Bird Observatory in California. Northern California. And so we're developing a prototype, focused on local species here, and developing the materials and supports that will enable adoption in other places.
So. Good. Any other questions?
In terms of your, I know your Gecko project is with Girl Scouts. I was just wondering if you had done anything around energy education in a formal setting and had any thoughts of, like, where in the curriculum they cover that, or if you haven't really done anything in that sort of environment.
No, I haven't done anything personally in the formal education environment, though I was at a... I was invited to talk at a a session that we put on at the Ecological Society, where we had folks from middle school through college level talking about energy education. And there were other folks there who have integrated it in fourth grade and sixth grade and ninth grade. So, you know, I think that there are connections at a lot of different levels, depending on
the ghetto context.
Not the ghetto context. No, energy. I thought you were asking a broader question about energy education, or were you asking about ghetto?
I was asking the broader question because we're starting to delve into that some, and it's not, you know, with the crowded curriculum and that sort of thing, I'm curious as to whether there's a standard place that it's easy to get people to incorporate it, or whether you really have to find the people who are innovating, and, you know, it's just a little bit of some people put it in here and some people there and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, so I think there's an opportunity somewhere in fourth through sixth grade, and then in beginning high school as well, maybe in environmental science, which is often taught in ninth grade, intro environmental science. The thing at the Ecological Society was specifically looking at the connections between energy education and ecology education, and so that's why 4 through 6 is good, because there's often a focus on ecosystem, you know, people are introduced to ecosystems there, and if you want to connect, you know, if you want to place humans in the ecosystem instead of studying them as a pristine thing that's unaffected, you know, that's separate, energy education is a good way to do that via climate change. Does that make sense, what I just said?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Can I follow up one more thing? I was just wondering if you, I mean, obviously ecology is very much a system science kind of science, and climate change is also very much that sort of a thing. It's got a lot of system science elements in it. I'm wondering if in your work you've sort of seen whether students kind of effectively transfer their sort of system science knowledge between those two domains, if they've studied ecology and sort of get the hang of some system science concepts when they move over to studying climate, do they, you know, successfully transfer that knowledge, or is that a struggle, or have you encountered anything with regards to that?
It is a struggle. I think that what we've seen is that if students are given the opportunity to reflect on their learning, they'll make those connections. You know, and that's the shortcoming most often, is that they're rushed and there's too much in the curriculum, and so the opportunity to think about what are elements of a system and how do they apply to other systems just doesn't happen enough. But if you do provide that scaffolding and explicitly get them to sort of engage in that meta-analysis, they'll get there.
So prompt them a bit and give them time to reflect. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, and explicitly ask them, okay, so you've identified these components of a pond ecosystem. What would they be in a boreal forest? And have them actually explicitly make the transfer as a sort of, you know, then progress to global in climate change. Or with climate change is to progress from a local to a regional to a global, you know, to scaffold the developing complexity of the concept by taking it piece by piece.
Great, thanks.
Are there any other questions? Well, okay, if not, I want to thank Julie for her presentation today and thank everybody else for the discussion, and we'll talk again next week.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. It was great to be given a gift of, you know, you never get a chance to sit back and think, okay, well, what have we been doing? And so that's just really a privilege for me as well.
Great. Well, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Tamara. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.